I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I'm doing another one of my solo streams today, and the main program is me reading my essay, Reflections on Carl Schmitt's The Concept of the Political. I will, however, be taking your questions. I'll take your questions on Carl Schmitt, and I'll take your questions on anything else for that matter. I would like the questions on current events and favorite movies or my favorite color or whatever to be reserved for the latter part of this stream in the last hour, though. So if you'd bear with me on that, I'd appreciate it. You can send your questions and comments along with a little donation to Entropy, entropystream.live/countercurrents. And we will get to that in the course of the show. I will gratefully thank everybody for their donation, and I will respond to your comment or question as best I can. I would also like to encourage you, if you want to chip in with your DLive tokens, to send me a diamond or two, a lemon or a ninjagini or whatever. I will definitely get to any DLive questions in the course of the stream, and I will, of course, be monitoring our friends at Odyssey as well. I have in the past neglected Odyssey, but the audience there is growing, and so I'm paying more attention. And I apologize for overlooking you folks in the past. So I want to give you just a few words about Carl Schmitt before we go into this essay of mine. Carl Schmitt was born in 1888 in Plettenberg in Westphalia, Germany. And he died in Plettenberg in 1985 at the age of 96. He was the son of a Roman Catholic small businessman. He studied law in Berlin, Munich, and Strasbourg, and he graduated and took his exams in 1915. In 1916, he earned his habilitation, which basically qualified him to be a law professor in Strasbourg. And he taught at business schools and universities in Munich, Bonn, Berlin, and Cologne. Now, during the Third Reich, Schmitt joined the NSDAP in May of 1933. He was appointed Prussian State Councilor and President of the Union of National Socialist Jurists. He particularly enjoyed the confidence and patronage of Hermann Göring, but from 1936 on, he was regarded as ideologically unsound by some within the SS. In 1945, he was arrested and interned for more than a year by American occupiers. He refused denazification and retired to Plettenberg, where he was born, and he continued to write, receive visitors, and quietly maintain his political contacts until the end of his life. Among his many visitors and correspondents were people such as Ernst Jünger, Alexander Kojève, Guillaume Fay, and Mircea Eliade. Was one as well. So he had a very impressive circle of friends. His correspondence is quite remarkable. And he is the most influential political philosopher of the 20th century, without question. He is regarded as an important figure by people up and down the ideological spectrum. He's too big to cancel, basically, over the fact that he was a Catholic reactionary, and later, for a while, a National Socialist, and then just a reactionary critic of modernity and liberalism. I think he's one of the great anti-liberal thinkers of all time. And I've taken a lot of inspiration from Schmitt over the years. And I've written a number of essays on him, which are linked at Countercurrents. I'm going to put up the Remembering Carl Schmitt piece that we run every year on his birthday, and that will give you a good list of all the Carl Schmitt related stuff, including the things that I've written, of course. So before I get into it, one more thing. I want to give a shout out to my friends gathering in the center of Ohio. It's high in the middle, I'm told, in Columbus. I'm excited about you getting together, and I'm really looking forward to a report on the festivities, on the gathering. Okay, so let's begin. With reflections on Carl Schmitt's concept of the political. I wrote this essay more than a decade ago, and I might just do a little editing as we go along. I might be doing a new edition of the book that it appeared in, which is called New Right versus Old Right. Carl Schmitt's short book, The Concept of the Political, 1932, is one of the most important works of 20th century political philosophy. The aim of the concept of the political is the defense of politics from utopian aspirations to abolish politics. Anti-political utopianism includes all forms of liberalism, as well as international socialism, global capitalism, anarchism, and pacifism. In short, all social philosophies that aim at a universal order in which conflict is abolished. In ordinary speech, of course, liberalism, international socialism, etc., are political movements, not anti-political ones. So it is clear that Schmitt is using political in a particular way. For Schmitt, the political is founded on the distinction between friend and enemy. Utopianism is anti-political insofar as it attempts to abolish that distinction, to root out all enmity and conflict in the world. Schmitt's defense of the political is not a defense of enmity and conflict as good things. Schmitt fully recognizes their destructiveness and the necessity of managing and mitigating them. But Schmitt believes that enmity is best controlled by adopting a realistic understanding of its nature. So Schmitt does not defend conflict, but realism about conflict. Indeed, Schmitt believes that the best way to contain conflict is first to abandon all unrealistic notions that one can do away with it entirely. Furthermore, Schmitt believes that utopian attempts to completely abolish conflict actually increase its scope and intensity. There is no war more universal in scope and fanatical in prosecution than wars to end all war and establish perpetual peace. Us and them. What does the distinction between friend and enemy mean? First, for Schmitt, the distinction between friend and enemy is collective. He is talking about us versus them, not one individual versus another. Schmitt introduces the Latin distinction between hostis, a collective or public enemy, the root of hostile, and inimicus, an individual and private adversary, the root of inimical. The political is founded on the distinction between friend, those on one side, and hostis, those on the other side. Private adversaries are not public enemies. Second, the distinction between friend and enemy is polemical. The friend-enemy distinction is always connected with the abiding potential for violence. One does not need to actually fight one's enemy, but the potential must always be there. The sole purpose of politics is not group conflict. The sole content of politics is not group conflict, but the abiding possibility of group conflict is what creates the political dimension of human social existence. Third, the distinction between friend and enemy is existentially serious. Violent conflict is more serious than other forms of conflict because when things get violent, people die. Fourth, the distinction between friend and enemy is not reducible to any other distinction. For instance, it is not reducible to the distinction between good and evil. The good guys are just as much enemies to the bad guys as the bad guys are enemies to the good guys. Enmity is relative, but morality, we hope, isn't. Fifth, although the friend-enemy distinction is not reducible to other distinctions and differences, religious, economic, philosophical, and so forth, all differences can become political if they generate the friend-enemy opposition. In sum, the ultimate root of the political is the capacity of human groups to take their differences so seriously that they will kill or die for them. A note here. Any distinction, religious, economic, philosophical, or so forth, can become existentially serious enough that groups of people will kill and die for them. And at that point, those distinctions become political. It is important to note that Schmitt's concept of the political does not apply to ordinary domestic politics. So when we talk about politics, and it's tempting to reach for Schmitt, when we talk about domestic politics and reach for Schmitt, he's not really using the term political in any way that's connected with domestic politics. The rivalries of politicians and parties, provided they stay within legal parameters, do not constitute enmity in Schmitt's sense. Schmitt's notion of politics applies primarily to foreign relations, the relations between sovereign states and peoples, rather than domestic relations within a society. The only time when domestic relations become political in Schmitt's sense is during a revolution or a civil war, or you can say in the lead-up period, a pre-Civil War period, where there are peoples living together in the same state who are beginning to regard one another as enemies. When people start thinking we'd be better off without these people, we can't live with these people, that's a pre-Civil War state, because you are basically giving up on the idea that a certain group of people can be part of the same political order with you. Now let's talk about sovereignty. If the political arises from the abiding possibility of collective life or death conflict, the political rules over all other areas of social life because of its existential seriousness, the fact that it has the recourse to the ultimate sanction, which is to kill. For Schmitt, political sovereignty is the power to determine the enemy and declare war. The sovereign is the person who makes that decision. Now, I need to make a little note here. There's a lot of discussion of Schmitt on sovereignty. And Schmitt always treats the sovereign as a person who is empowered to make decisions. Now, this is not really consistent with the use of sovereignty in this sense. For instance, the idea that the people are sovereign. To talk about the people as being sovereign means that a political order is not legitimate if it does not look out for the objective interests of the people. And to make sure that it does, you generally need to empower the people to take part in political life. Otherwise, they just have to trust other people to look out for their interests, which is not a smart thing. So when you talk about the sovereignty of the people, we're not talking about a decision maker, right? When you talk about the sovereign people, you're not talking about a decision maker. So when Schmitt is talking about the sovereign, really he's using the sovereign to refer to an executive, a decision maker, a president or a king or a general, a dictator, some kind of figure who has the power to decide who is the enemy and who is the friend, basically the person who has the power to declare war, the war leader, the war chief, the commander in chief. That's who he's thinking about as the sovereign. He's thinking about the sovereign as a person who has executive power over life and death, and specifically in the realm of declaring war. Because again, the political is always connected with enmity, which is the possibility of different peoples fighting it out to the death. So I'm just going to repeat this section now. If the political arises from the abiding possibility of collective life or death conflict, the political rules over all other areas of social life because of its existential seriousness, the fact that it has recourse to the ultimate sanction. For Schmitt, political sovereignty is the power to determine the enemy and declare war. The sovereign is the person who makes that decision. If a sovereign declares an enemy, and individuals or groups within a society reject that declaration, the society is in a state of undeclared civil war or revolution. To refuse the sovereign's choice of enemy is one step away from the sovereign act of choosing one's own enemies. The Schmitz analysis supports the saying that war is when the government tells you who the bad guy is. Revolution is when you decide that for yourself. So I'm going to pause now and just check for questions and comments so we don't zip by people. Okay, I'm looking at entropy here. People are making complaints about audio glitches. I hope that's not a serious problem. Okay, Schmitz's critique of modernity is absolutely scathing, says Bob. That's absolutely correct. I'm going to pop over now to our friends at DLive. So let's just see what we've got going on here at DLive. I see that one lemon donator has donated one lemon. This is most welcome. Wait a second here. Okay. One lemon donator has donated one lemon. I'm hoping that one Ninjet donator will chime in soon. Some Chan has donated one lemon. Anglian has donated two lemons. The Thin Red Line, two ice cream. The Thin Red Line, seven lemons. And Slog has donated 12 lemons. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So I'm going to now check our friends at Entropy. Give me one second here. Okay, Jasper has written in with $50. This is most generous. Thank you. You made the point that Schmitz's concept of the political applies to foreign rather than domestic relations. Hence me stopping now because this is relevant, right? And the only time when domestic relations become political is during civil war or revolution. In the U.S., the sovereign has declared nationalists the enemy, but we have rejected that. How would you characterize the current status of the United States? I think the United States is in a pre-Civil War situation and has been for a very long time. Really, it's been that way for 400 years when you get right down to it. Why? Well, because there are incompatible groups of people in friend-enemy relations in a state of enmity trying to live in the political system. And as Thomas Jefferson pointed out so wisely, these two races, he's thinking of blacks and whites, cannot live together under the same system. And of course, now we've added to the problems of diversity by opening our borders to the third world. And so we have multiplied the diversity. We've multiplied the number of groups of people who are enemies, basically. They might not be openly hostile, but they are distinct in their identities. They have distinct interests. And they're here to take things from the founding stock of the country. They're here to take from you and me. It's only a matter of time before the organized looting that's been going on, basically enabled by the Democratic Party, I would say organized by the Democratic Party and enabled by the passivity of the Republican Party. The peaceful, orderly looting of white America will eventually become open, violent looting and destruction. And at that point, white people will start fighting back. When will that happen? Only God knows. But it can happen any minute because the system is extremely unstable. So I think that America is in a kind of pre-Civil War situation. And the main thing that's preventing this from kicking off is the cluelessness of whites. Whites are basically taught to think in terms of liberal ideologies. They're taught to think of themselves as merely human beings, as not white people with a particular identity and particular interests. They're taught to think of America and not as a community, but as a universal nation that anybody can belong to. And because they think these anti-political ideas, they're incapable of basically understanding what's happening in front of them, which is that enemies are converging upon them and taking their society away. These old goofy cucks like Lindsey Graham actually think that he can be part of the same society as Ilhan Omar and Ocasio-Cortez and these incredibly obnoxious third world bimbos, basically, who have been elected into the Congress in recent years. He thinks that we can all just get along. And which is why I use this question from Rodney King. Can't we all just get along? No, we can't. The liberal hope is that we can all get along somehow, but we can't. And as we, as white people wake up from the trance of liberalism, from the trance of this apolitical, anti-political, universalistic ideology that they've accepted, they'll realize that what's going on is sort of a low-intensity war against them, against our tribe, by other tribes, basically. So, yeah, I think the United States is in a pre-Civil War situation, and the main thing that's preventing that from happening is just the widespread cluelessness of white Americans because of the ideology, the liberal universalist ideology that Americans accept. So Gadius writes in with 20 US dollars. Thank you very much. Schmidt seems to take Machiavelli to task for not being Machiavellian and dismisses the prince as ill-reputed. What's going on here? Wouldn't Machiavelli be right up Schmidt's alley as a political realist? Okay, that's a good question, and I will actually get to that later, after I finish going through this essay. So I want to just check and see if we have some other questions or comments here, and then we'll move forward back into the text. I want to talk about a few parallels between Schmidt and other thinkers. The root of the political, as Schmidt understands it, is what Plato and Aristotle call thumos, the middle part of the soul that is neither theoretical reason nor physical desire, but it's rather a capacity for passionate attachment. Thumos is the root of the political because it is the source of attachments to one, groups, and politics is collective, and two, to life-transcending and life-negating values. That is to say, things that are worth killing and dying for, like the defense of personal or collective honor, one's cultural way of life, religious and philosophical convictions, and so forth. Such values make possible mortal conflict between groups. The abolition of the political, therefore, requires the abolition of the human capacity for passionate, existentially serious life or death attachments. The apolitical man is therefore the apathetic man, the man who lacks commitment and intensity. He is what Nietzsche called the last man, the man for whom there is nothing higher than himself, nothing that might require that he risk the continuation of his physical existence. The apolitical utopia is a spiritual boneless chicken ranch of doped up, dumbed down, self-absorbed producer consumers. The boneless chicken ranch is a Far Side cartoon, a Gary Larson Far Side cartoon from decades and decades ago. And it's absolutely hilarious because people were, advertising, you can buy boneless chicken. And so he envisioned a world where you can grow boneless chickens. And the boneless chicken ranch is basically a farm where you have all these chickens that can't stand. So they're just sort of draped everywhere, right? They're spineless. It's the spineless chicken ranch. They basically have no backbone. They've got nothing that stands up, okay? And I thought that was a nice image. Another image that you could use here is from The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. He has a chapter there called Men Without Chests. And the ancients believed, the Greeks believed, that thumos resided in the chest. So if you're a man without a chest, that really means you're a man who lacks thumos. You lack the capacity for these strong, existentially serious attachments to values that might transcend your own life. And you lack the capacity to feel attachment to other human beings and especially your group. And thumos for Plato and Aristotle is the part of the soul that gives rise to the whole political dimension of reality. Schmidt's notion of the political is consistent with Hegel's notion of history. For Hegel, history is a record of individual and collective struggles to the death over images or interpretations of who we are. These interpretations consist of the whole realm of culture, worldviews and ways of life that are worldviews and the ways of life that are their concrete manifestations. There are, of course, many interpretations of who we are, but there's only one truth, and according to Hegel, the truth is that man is free. Just as philosophical dialectic works through a plurality of conflicting viewpoints to get to the one truth, so the dialectic of history is a war of conflicting worldviews and ways of life that will come to an end when the correct worldview and way of life are established. The concept of human freedom must become concretely realized in a way of life that recognizes freedom. Then history, as Hegel understands it, and politics, as Schmitt understands it, will come to an end. Hegel's notion of the ideal post-historical state is pretty much everything that a 20th or 21st century fascist could desire. But later interpreters of Hegel, like Alexander Kojève and his follower Francis Fukuyama, interpret the end of history as a universal homogeneous state that sounds a lot like the globalist utopianism that Schmitt wished to combat. Why the political cannot be abolished? If the political is rooted in human nature, then it cannot be abolished. Even if the entire planet could be turned into a boneless chicken ranch, all it would take is two serious men to start politics and history all over again. But the utopians will never even get that far. Politics cannot be abolished by universal declarations of peace, love, and tolerance, for such attempts to transcend politics actually just reinstitute it on another plane. After all, utopian peace and love mongers have enemies too, namely haters like us. Thus, the abolition of politics is really only the abolition of honesty about politics. But dishonesty is the least of the utopians' vices. For in the name of peace and love, they persecute us with a fanaticism and wanton destructiveness that makes good old-fashioned war seem wholesome by comparison. Two peoples occupying adjacent valleys might, for strategic reasons, covet the high ground between them. This may lead to conflict. But such conflicts have finite, definable aims. Thus, they tend to be limited in scope and duration. And since it is a mere conflict of interests, in which both sides really are right, rather than a moral or religious crusade between good and evil, light and darkness, ultimately, both sides can strike a deal with each other to cease hostilities. But when war is wedded to a universalist utopianism, global communism or democracy, the end of terror or, more ridiculously, evil, it becomes universal in scope and endless in duration. It is universal because it proposes to represent all of humanity. It is endless, of course, because it is at war with human nature itself. Furthermore, when war is declared in the name of humanity, its prosecution becomes maximally inhuman, since anything is fair against the enemies of humanity, who deserve nothing short of unconditional surrender or annihilation, since one cannot strike a bargain with evil incarnate. The road to Dresden, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki was paved with love, universalistic, utopian, humanistic, liberal love. The kind of love that just radiates from Justin Trudeau, for instance. Liberalism. Liberalism seeks to reduce the friend-enemy distinction to differences of opinion or economic interests. The liberal utopia is one in which all disputes can be resolved bloodlessly by reasoning or bargaining. But the opposition between liberalism and anti-liberalism cannot be resolved by liberal means. It is perforce political. Liberal anti-politics cannot triumph, therefore, without the political elimination of anti-liberalism. The abolition of the political requires the abolition of all differences so there is nothing to fight over, or the abolition of all seriousness so that differences make no difference. The abolition of difference is accomplished by violence and cultural assimilation. The abolition of seriousness is accomplished by the promotion of spiritual apathy through consumerism and indoctrination and relativism, individualism, tolerance, and diversity worship, the whole multi-cult. Violence, of course, is generally associated with frankly totalitarian forms of anti-political utopianism like communism, but the Second World War shows that liberal universalists are as capable of violence as communists. They're just less capable of honesty about it. Liberalism, however, generally prefers to kill us softly. The old-fashioned version of liberalism prefers the soft dissolution of differences through cultural assimilation, but that preference was reversed when the unassimilable Jewish minority rose to power in the United States, at which time multiculturalism and diversity became the watchwords, and the potential conflicts between different groups were to be managed through spiritual corruption. Today's liberals make a fetish of the preservation of pluralism and diversity as long as none of it is taken seriously. Multicultural utopianism is doomed because multiculturalism is very successful at increasing diversity, but in the long run, it cannot manage the conflicts that come with it. The drug of consumerism cannot be relied upon because economic crises cannot be eliminated. Furthermore, there are absolute ecological limits to the globalization of consumerism. As for the drugs of relativism, individualism, tolerance, and the multicult, only whites are susceptible to their effects. And since these ideas systematically disadvantage whites in ethnic competition, ultimately those whites who accept them will be destroyed, which is the point, really. And those whites who survive will reject them. Then whites will start taking our own side, ethnic competition will get political, and one way or another, racially and ethnically homogeneous states will emerge. Now I want to talk about lessons for white nationalists from Schmidt. To become a white nationalist is to choose one's friends and one's enemies for oneself. To choose new friends means to choose a new nation. Our nation is our race. Now, I want to pause here. I don't like that kind of formulation anymore because it encourages the idea of just one nation for the white race, right? Which is a meaningless, grandiose idea. So I don't like that kind of talk anymore, and I would probably edit that out. But to choose new friends means to choose a new nation. And in the context of the United States, though, we are choosing white America. Our people means white America. And so in a sense, the outer boundaries of our nation are racial. That doesn't mean that every white person belongs to the same polity, but it does mean that in America, being an American is a white thing. A necessary condition of being an American is being a white person. Our enemies are all the enemies of our race, whatever race they may be. By choosing our friends and enemies for ourselves, white nationalists have constituted ourselves as a sovereign people. A sovereign people that does not have a sovereign homeland yet. And we have rejected the sovereignty of those who rule us. This puts us in an implicitly revolutionary position vis-a-vis all existing regimes. Now, that paragraph is a little ambiguous because I'm using sovereign in two different ways that I've identified. One is the sovereign is the executive and the other is the sovereign people. By rejecting multiculturalism and by affirming the essential whiteness of America, that puts us in an implicitly revolutionary position vis-a-vis the regime. Conservatives among us don't see that yet. They still wish to cling to America's corpse and suckle from her poisoned teat. But the enemy understands us better than some of us understand ourselves. We may not wish to choose an enemy, but sometimes the enemy chooses us. I'm referring to those clueless, colorblind conservative types who don't want to fight a racial battle. They will do anything but defend white people. They will go to any lengths of cowardice and euphemism and circumlocution to deny the racial nature of the attack that's being mounted against us. They don't want other races to be their enemy, but they don't get to choose that. Sometimes the enemy chooses us, and if we don't fight the battle that's brought to us, we lose and we perish. Thus, mainstreamers, the people who sort of think in terms of cozying up with the GOP, are going to be denied entry into polite society, and they're going to be forced to choose to either abandon white nationalism or to explicitly embrace his revolutionary destiny. It may be too late for mainstream politics, but it is still too early for white nationalist politics. We simply do not have the power to win a political struggle. We lack manpower, money, and leadership, but the present system, like all things old and dissolute, will pass, and our community, like all things young and healthy, will grow in size and strength. Thus, today, our task is metapolitical, to raise consciousness and cultivate the community from which our kingdom or our republic will come. And when that day comes, Carl Schmitt will be numbered among our spiritual founding fathers. This was from February of 2011. So 11 years ago, almost exactly, is when I wrote this and published it. So I want to now go to questions. And I want to go to the question that was given me by Gadius. Basically, he wants to know what Schmitt's beef is with Machiavelli. Okay, so I'm going to just read the passage that he's thinking about from the concept of the political. This is on page 65 at the bottom to 66 at the top. And then I'm going to explain what's going on here, because he doesn't really have a beef with Machiavelli. Political thinkers, political realists is what he's referring to, are always aware of the concrete possibility of an enemy. Their realism can frighten men in need of security. Without wanting to decide the question of the nature of man, one may say in general that as long as man is well off or willing to put up with things, he prefers the illusion of an undisturbed calm and does not endure pessimists. The political adversaries of clear political theory will, therefore, easily refute political phenomena and truths in the name of some autonomous discipline as amoral, uneconomical, unscientific, and above all, declare this, and this is politically relevant, a devilry worthy of being combated. So what's he talking about here? He's basically talking about the vast majority of people, especially under bourgeois modernity, are placid types. And that's really true in every age. The vast majority of people are tillers of the soil. They're worried about basically making their way through life, feeding their families, keeping a roof over their heads, and things like that. They want to focus on these things. They're wrapped up in comfort and security and survival. And to do that, they want peace and quiet. And when political thinkers come along and say, politics springs from enmity, politics is always haunted by the fact that the possibility of existentially serious conflict between groups that leads to death and destruction. That's a downer. Nobody wants to hear that, right? And so they start talking about political realists as bloody-minded fanatics that have to be silenced. We can't have these bloody-minded fanatics going around talking about bad things. These people are immoral. They have to be shut up. They have to be deplatformed or denied tenure or whatever way that people shut up these pessimists, these realists about politics. And this is what Schmitt's talking about. He's talking about this attempt to basically silence political realism under the guise of it being immoral at the behest of people who don't want to deal with reality, who want to basically go back to sleep and just dream that life can be peaceful and quiet and nobody needs to think about politics or war, okay? And then he goes on, he says, this misfortune, and by this misfortune, he means being condemned as devilry by placid-minded dullards. Being condemned as a devil figure by placid-minded dullards occurred to Machiavelli, who, had he been a Machiavellian, would sooner have written an edifying book than his ill-reputed Prince. The Prince is a pretty brutal, realistic book about politics, and it's been constantly condemned as immoral because it counsels doing things like killing your enemies, as if there's anything else you can really do with them in the heat of battle, because you can't always make friends, right? You can't always make friends. There's always going to be us and them. You might be at ease with your enemies for a period of time, but there's always going to be the possibility that things get serious and violent, okay? Okay, so in actuality, Machiavelli was on the defensive, as was also his country, Italy, which in the 16th century had been invaded by Germans, Frenchmen, Spaniards, and Turks. At the beginning of the 19th century, the situation of the ideological defensive was repeated in Germany during the revolutionary and Napoleonic invasions of the French. When it became important for the German people to defend themselves against an expanding enemy armed with a humanitarian ideology, Machiavelli was rehabilitated by Fichte and Hegel. So what's he saying here? He's basically saying this. Machiavelli wrote very, very frankly about war and enmity and the necessity of killing and things like that in the context of his century, where his nation, it's Italy, was divided and into many states and was constantly being invaded and trounced by larger, better organized peoples, the Spanish, the French, the Germans, the Turks. They preyed upon Italy. And in The Prince, what Machiavelli tried to do is create a manual for the kind of political leader, the kind of ruthless political leader who could unite Italy and make it safe from these external invaders who were abusing it. And in that context, he was remarkably frank about what goes into political leadership. And because of that, he's been condemned as immoral. If he were more Machiavellian in the sense of sneaky, he wouldn't have been so frank. But Schmidt's explanation for why he's so frank is that he felt it was necessary in the context to be frank because things were too serious to beat around the bush. And he says that in the early 19th century, when the French were invading and occupying Germany, you know, there was a such thing as French-occupied Germany at the beginning of the 19th century, the Germans rehabilitated necessity under the same sort of political pressure. Suddenly, when your nation is being invaded and occupied by foreigners, you become more willing to speak frankly about political realities. And so Machiavelli is often rehabilitated in times of trouble when you can't beat around the bush about what politics really entails. So I think that's a pretty good answer. So thank you, Gadius. You've been very generous. So let me just go back to our friends at DLive. Norse Nature has donated one ice cream. Thank you, Norse Nature, 14 lemons. And 1001 Cuts has donated one ninjagini. That's very, very generous. Okay, I'm just going to go through and read a bunch of the comments here because a lot of them are good. Okay. Our enemies do worse to our race compared to killing us. They turn our people trans, which is a form of torture. This is true. And I do think there's a significant amount of evil cackling. You see the meme of the lizard people doubled up in laughter at their cocktail parties, talking about what they've done to us most recently. There's definitely some truth to that. There's definitely a level of sadism on the part of people who are promoting transsexualism for kids. There's definitely an element of sadism amongst the people who are promoting eating bugs and getting rid of beef. And, you know, everybody having to dress in Mao suits and live in pods so we can be equal with the third world. There's a huge amount of evil cackling inhumanity there, evil cackling sadism in these sorts of things. I mean, you just have to call these people out on it, okay? Let's just check here and see if there's some questions and comments about Schmidt. Okay, so Spartan Superior 1 says, minorities are passive when they're tiny. Once they gain 10% or more, they show their true colors. This is true, although we have a minority that's far smaller than 10% that's become extremely aggressive and obnoxious. So they don't even have to get to 10% before they start really creating problems. They just have to be in charge of your television network or your bank. You know, sometimes strength doesn't come from numbers. It comes from control over the high points of the society, the control of business and banking and government and academia and the media and so forth. There are some market dominant minorities whose sense of destiny makes them want to monopolize hardware stores in France or cheap hotels in the South. And there are other market-dominant minorities who have a higher sense of destiny that leads them to try and control banking, politics, academia, the media, and so forth. Apollo Invictus writes in, non-whites are only nice when we're debasing ourselves and giving away our birthright with a smile. Deny them this and see their hatred. Yes, yeah, just say no. We've lost the ability to say no because we don't even know who we are. As a group anymore. And we've lost the ability to say no. And a person who has no ability to say no is little more than a slave. We have a slave ethics, basically, that's been insinuated into the minds of white people. So they have to apologize all the time. They have to give way. The only time that they can speak about white people as a group is to abase themselves, never to be proud of things, but always to talk about white guilt, how bad we are. That's basically the slave morality that we've gotten. So Gaddis writes, Waukesha, or I like to say Waukesha happens, conservatives, this is the left. Okay. And Bartleby is shilling the writer's block. Yes, that reminds me. I'll shill it later. Okay, so let's check over at Entropy again and see if we have some more questions or comments here. Okay, I am going to now do something because I zipped right through that. I zipped through it and yeah, I thought it was pretty good. So I want to talk more about Schmidt. Oh, wait a second. Mary Ann has written in. Mary Ann has written in, and she wants to know, what are my thoughts about Leo Strauss's critique of the concept of the political? Now, if you have the little edition of the concept of the political that was published by the University of Chicago Press, it has the review of the concept of political published by Leo Strauss. And Carl Schmitt said that he felt really X-rayed by Strauss. He thought Strauss was extremely insightful. And he actually helped Strauss after Strauss had to leave Germany in the 1930s for obvious reasons. Yeah, he helped him get a Rockefeller Foundation grant to go study at Oxford to work on Hobbes, the political philosophy of Thomas Hobbes. And then Strauss went off to the United States. But the essay by Strauss at the end is very important. The main lesson or argument that people take away from this is that Strauss argues that there's something liberal about Schmitt, even though he's a critic of liberalism. And the argument basically goes like this, and I'm going to actually just read some passages here, but I want to try and summarize it before I read it. What Schmitt says, according to Strauss, is that he's trying to defend the political as such. He's trying to defend the whole dimension of reality that gives rise to politics as such against anti-political utopianism. And because he's trying to basically step back from the concrete political struggles and the things that people are struggling about, and just talk about the political as a dimension of human existence and defend it against its critics and against the people who want to deny it. Strauss says, in a way, he's being a kind of liberal because, according to Strauss, the defining characteristic of liberalism is a kind of neutrality, the creation of a political realm that's neutral, right? We want to be neutral about certain values. We want to be neutral about religion and things like that. So when Schmitt takes up this attitude that he wants to defend the political as such, regardless of what people are fighting about, what defines these conflicts, Strauss says he's being somewhat quote-unquote liberal. Now, I think that that's a merely verbal and merely clever argument, and it's not all that clever. You know, it's just superficially clever. Schmitt wants to reject the idea that you can create a political realm that's basically free of all serious conflicts, and therefore he rejects liberalism. Liberalism basically tries to neutralize conflict. And again, the way that it tries to neutralize conflict is twofold. One, it tries to wear away all distinctions, tries to homogenize everything, get rid of the distinctions between people that people will fight about. And the other thing that it tries to do, if it can't wear away distinctions, is it tries to destroy seriousness, right? So even though there are differences, you don't take them seriously enough to fight about, right? So liberal society loves diversity, but it's always a diversity of superficial things, superficial choices that are not existentially serious, and everybody's just sort of smirkingly ironic about it and playful about it, because to take any differences seriously is dangerous to liberalism. So liberalism has to basically wear away differences and wear away seriousness so that we don't have anything to fight about anymore. And that's how it neutralizes things, how it creates a neutral public realm where we can just all get along because we're not different, or if we are different, we don't take it seriously enough to fight over. I don't think that there's any deep and important analogy between that view of politics and what Schmitt is doing by saying, let's take a step back and defend the political as such. What's he defending? What's he doing by defending the political as such? What he's doing is this. He's looking at ideologies who say that we can get rid of seriousness. We can get rid of conflict. We can all live at peace. And he's trying to say that basically that's not compatible with human nature. Now, it's very interesting that at the time he was writing, he was saying that Schmitt was writing, he didn't really make any reference to Plato or Aristotle or Thumos or anything like that. And Strauss was sort of in his pre-classical philosopher phase, he didn't really talk about that either. But I think looking at what's going on here, you can say that what Schmitt is doing is he's defending the element of human nature that modern philosophy tries to overlook or domesticate or eliminate, which is the thumotic aspect of human nature that leads us to be attached to groups and attached to values that we're willing to die and kill over. And so when Schmitt is defending the possibility of the political, he's defending human nature from its denial and attempts to deform it. And that's not equivalent to saying that he's being neutral about what the things that people fight about in sort of a liberal way, that he's taking up a kind of nihilistic stance, saying that, you know, seriousness is important no matter what you're serious about. The kind of nihilism that says, I admire integrity in a communist or a liberal or anybody. That's a crazy, dumb idea. It's an implicitly nihilistic idea to say that. And that's not what Schmidt's doing. He's not saying, I admire all seriousness, no matter what it's about, which is a kind of liberal open-mindedness. What he's saying is he wants to defend seriousness because it's part of human nature that's being overlooked and denied by liberal theory. So that doesn't make him a liberal in some ironic way, as Strauss argues. So I'm not all that impressed with Strauss's critique in the end. However, I do think that the way he lays out what's going on in the concept of the political is very impressive. I just don't think that his main critical gotcha at the end is a particularly telling criticism, to be perfectly honest. So that takes care of Marianne's argument. Thank you, Marianne. I want to check and see if I have any more questions that have popped up in entropy. Nope. And I'm going to be looking into Odyssey now. Let's see what's going on at Odyssey, folks. Okay. Is Countercurrent still publishing books? Yes, we're still publishing books. We're not taking new book projects right now, but we are going through a huge backlog of old book projects. The biggest project that I'm working on right now, and it's going off to the press as early as next week for a proof copy, basically, to be printed, is Francis Parker Yockey's The Enemy of Europe. And of course, Yockey was very much influenced by Schmidt. And The Enemy of Europe is talking about enmity. And his discussion in there is very Schmittian. In fact, years ago, when I edited the Occidental Quarterly, I commissioned a study by a Schmidt scholar of Yockey, because it was said by people that Yockey had plagiarized Schmidt, just outright imported big chunks of the concept of the political into Imperium. And so I had this Schmidt scholar go through Imperium, and sure enough, he found that Yockey had just ripped off big chunks of Schmidt, paraphrased him, and put it into Imperium without putting quotes around it or citations or anything like that. So that, you know, if Yockey were an academic or turning this in an academic setting, he'd be flunked for plagiarism, right? Yockey didn't look at what he was doing as scholarship. He thought that what he was doing was a polemic. And he says at the beginning of Imperium that there's nothing new or original in the book. He didn't publish it under his own name. He actually tried to get Sir Oswald Mosley to publish it under his name. Mosley dodged a bullet. He would go down in history as a plagiarist rather than Yockey if he had done that. Yockey also did a lot of writing and quoting from memory. He had a prodigious memory. So I don't think that he was just trying to pass off Schmidt's insights as his own. I think that was just sort of unworthy. I think that all of these ideas were sort of fused together and put out. If you want to say that Yockey's a plagiarist, you'd have to say that the biggest guy he plagiarizes is Spengler. He's just reformulating vast tracts of Spengler as well. The point for him was not to pretend that he was an original thinker. The point for him was to get these ideas out into circulation. And to the extent that he thought that there were very valuable things in the concept of the political, he incorporated them into Imperium. Technically, you know, you'd have to flunk him if he were handing this in class. We are still publishing books, and The Enemy of Europe is the next one. I'm also publishing a fifth anthology of my film essays under the name Trevor Lynch. Okay, so Greg Goulet writes, I was reading up on socialism with Chinese characteristics and was surprised at how much they invoke Schmidt. The modern CCP still has the aesthetic of Marxist Lenin Mao, but behind the scenes, it seems that they take much more realistic political view and employ reactionary thinkers. I completely agree. Schmidt is highly thought of in China. That is definitely true. So I'm going to check and see if we got some more questions, comments, and Ninjaginis over at DLive. Okay. No, I'm not seeing anything really new here. So folks, we've come to 1 hour, and I think I've basically covered this. And I want to just plunge forward and see if I can do some more Schmidt discussion here. And what I'm going to do is read an essay that I wrote called Schmidt, Sovereignty, and the Deep State, because it is related to all of these things. It's about 2,100 words, and I'll go through this, and then we'll wrap up. And we'll see if there are more questions, of course, and then we'll wrap up. You know, if there were this were a classroom, this would be the time when you hear the chalkboard, you know, tap, tap, tap on the chalkboard. Forgive me. Anyway, so let's go forward. In Political Theology, his short book on the concept of sovereignty, Carl Schmitt states, "Sovereign is he who decides on the exception. Sovereignty means supreme political authority as opposed to political subjection." That's what you would say about a sovereign state or a sovereign individual. Within a society, the sovereign is the ruler as opposed to the ruled. A sovereign nation rules itself as opposed to being ruled by others. For Schmitt, law and bureaucracy can deal with normal day-to-day life. But as Aristotle pointed out, generalizations about human affairs pertain only for the most part. In addition to normal circumstances, there are exceptional circumstances in which functionaries cannot simply apply the existing laws. The supreme power cannot lie in laws which are administered by bureaucracies. Supreme power reposes in the person who decides what to do in exceptional cases, when the codifications of past experience are not enough to guide us. Schmitt's concept of sovereignty is beguilingly simple, but when one thinks it through, the implications for the liberal project are devastating. One of the leading slogans of liberalism is government by laws, not men, meaning that sovereignty ultimately rests with laws rather than individual men. We hear this cliche all the time about the rule of law, right? Bad people don't follow the rule of law. Orban doesn't follow the rule of law. The rule of law is being threatened in Poland, and so on and so forth. Okay. The desirability of government by laws can be appreciated by imagining a utopia in which there are no laws, just a wise and benevolent judge who looks at the unique circumstances of every dispute and intuits the just decision. There are two basic problems with this utopia. First, there's no guarantee that the judge will always be wise and benevolent, and if he fails to deliver justice, then we would need a way to remedy the situation. That remedy cannot consist simply of another man who is empowered to fix the problem, because what if he becomes corrupt or capricious? Obviously, we cannot leave decisions in the hands of men. There have to be principles for evaluating decisions and rules for reviewing and correcting them, which means reposing sovereignty in general principles or laws. Second, if every dispute is treated as a unique situation with a unique just outcome, this makes life rather unpredictable. But unpredictability undermines social cooperation, order, and progress. Large business endeavors, for example, involve tremendous financial risks, but people will hesitate to undertake such risks if there's not a legal structure in place that allows them to predict the likely outcomes of certain conflicts. Therefore, we need a code of general laws. And since a lot of conflicts are pretty much the same, there's no harm in having general rules to adjudicate them. The liberal dream is to ensure that everybody is treated justly by submitting all human decisions to rules. These rules can be applied according to other rules. Individual decision makers cannot only follow rules, they can be chosen according to still other rules, and their positions can be based on objective qualifications. That is to say, educational attainments and professional certifications. The aim is a society in which justice is produced by a well-oiled, rule-governed machine of free that's free of human bias, arbitrariness, and corruption. In order to ensure that the machine performs, it must have built-in self-monitoring and self-correcting mechanisms. It need not depend upon the moral or intellectual virtues of its functionaries if it can watch all their actions, double-check all their decisions, and reward or punish them accordingly. Just as the Catholic sacraments can be dispensed by a corrupt priest, justice can be produced by bored, cynical, and indifferent bureaucrats as long as the machine functions according to its rules. This was actually laid out by some of the American founders. I believe Madison talked about creating a government that was a machine that produces justice, that would run of itself, and that did not require public virtue. That is a very liberal idea. One of the ways that you can understand what liberalism is an attempt to create a society without depending upon virtue. And that's very important. If you can have a society that produces good results without presupposing human virtue, isn't that a great thing? Because virtue is so rare. Right? Wouldn't it be nice if we could have a society where things happen all for the good and you don't have to be virtuous? You could be selfish or bored, right? You can just be greedy, but through the magic of the system, your greed, your petty mindedness, your boredom, your selfishness, whatever, it all ends up producing good results for everybody. That's part of the liberal dream. So you can have a good society without particularly decent people. That's part of the liberal dream. In sum, one, liberalism wishes to repose sovereignty in law, not men. The ultimate law being the Constitution, which is the blueprint of a vast justice and fairness dispensing machine. Two, liberalism believes that human decision is a corrupting force in government. Thus, decisions must be eliminated where possible and subjected to rules where unavoidable. The ideal government is a machine like the Newtonian mechanical model of the universe, which requires no recourse to divine intervention. Decisions in government are like miracles in nature, arbitrary ghosts to be exorcised from the machine. Liberalism believes that sovereignty can be divided, that the machinery of government can diagnose and correct itself. This includes such notions as judicial review and bureaucratic auditing, but at the highest constitutional level, it is the idea of the separation of powers which check and balance each other. Liberalism believes that if government is sufficiently rule-governed and self-correcting, it need not depend on extraordinary human moral virtue. Honest, wise, and disinterested men are rare, but all people wish to enjoy pleasure and avoid pain. Thus, the most stable foundation of political order is greed and fear. Everybody has greed. Everybody feels fear. Optimally dispensing such rewards and punishments requires extensive surveillance and auditing, so nobody gets away with anything. Just as hell is an instrument of divine love, the modern bureaucratic surveillance state is an instrument of liberal fairness. The weakness of the liberal model is that human decisions can only be regulated by general rules when dealing with normal circumstances. That is to say, with circumstances anticipated by legislators that fall under their rules. But what about exceptional circumstances that do not fall under rules? Circumstances that were not foreseen and provided for in advance. These call for decisions. Now, in the case of a judge or a bureaucrat, these decisions can be subjected to higher order review, which can itself be governed by rules. But what happens when we get to the very top of the legal hierarchy, the Constitution itself? What happens when a constitutional order encounters a situation that was not anticipated by the founders and cannot be subsumed under their laws? Then the preservation of the constitutional order depends upon human decision rather than decision depending upon the constitutional order. decisions can be guided by the Constitution only in circumstances foreseen by the founders. In unforeseen circumstances, decisions must be guided by something higher. Sovereignty, in Schmitt's sense, thus lies in the hands of men who decide in exceptional circumstances. Specifically, they decide when exceptional circumstances are at hand, and they decide what to do about them. At that point, the only thing that the legal system can do is specify who is empowered to make such decisions. If sovereignty ultimately reposes in men, not laws, this is true even in liberal systems, which officially deny it. Liberal societies are simply ruled by secret sovereigns, men who exercise decision as they hide behind the laws. In liberal society, there are two kinds of secret sovereigns. First, there are the founders, the framers of the constitutional order, who decided what the fundamental laws will be. Laws are ultimately created by decisions. Thus, those who believe that decisions must always be governed by laws are simply abandoning their own freedom and responsibility and choosing to be ruled by the free decisions of those who came before them. Just as the deist model of the universe depends upon divine wisdom to frame its laws and set the machine in motion, liberals depend upon the human wisdom of the founders who created the Constitution. Second, since the founders of our liberal system could not anticipate every exceptional circumstance, sovereignty must be exercised in the present day as well. Some liberal societies actually make constitutional provisions granting unlimited dictatorial power to an individual in emergency situations, like when the truckers strike, for instance. Article 48 of the Weimar Constitution was invoked by Adolf Hitler to take dictatorial power. But if a society makes no legal provisions for sovereign decisions in emergency situations, such decisions must still be made. Thus, they will be made outside the framework of the official state. Such decisions may be made by important political figures, but not in their official capacities, which do not permit such decisions. This, of course, is what is meant by the idea of the deep state, which, interestingly enough, is a Turkish contribution to contemporary political discourse. In fact, I think it's the only Turkish contribution to contemporary political discourse. The Turkish idea of the deep state, the Derin Devlet, I'm sure that's butchering the pronunciation, refers to a network concentrated in the military and security services, but spread throughout the bureaucracy and judiciary and intersecting with organized crime. It's a network of people. The deep state works to maintain Turkey as a secular nationalist society, primarily working against Islamists, left-wing radicals, and Kurdish separatists. The Turkish deep state seems to intersect with the crypto-Jewish Donme community as well. A similar deep state heaved into the light in Egypt when the Supreme Council of Armed Forces, in response to the Egyptian Revolution of 2011, removed President Hosni Mubarak from power. The Supreme Council then called elections, ceded power to the winner, Mohamed Morsi, and dissolved itself in June of 2012. In July of 2013, when Morsi proved unable to govern, he was removed in a military coup led by the Supreme Council. By Supreme Council member, he was removed by this guy named Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who's now the president of Egypt. After the coup, the Supreme Council was officially reactivated, although its members were surely enclosed. Deactivated, although I'm sure all of its members were in close contact with each other, particularly in the run-up to the coup. Now, the concept of a deep state overlaps with such notions as an establishment, a permanent bureaucracy, secret agency, smoke-filled rooms, lobbies, political inner parties, NGOs and quangos, and even secret societies, you know, skull and bones and that kind of stuff, all of which shape political policy and negotiate between interest groups, which is just politics as usual. But in Schmitt's terms, this has nothing to do with sovereignty, which comes to light when politics as usual breaks down. And in the cases of Turkey and Egypt, when the political system has been paralyzed by crisis, the deep state centered in the military intervened to preserve a secular nationalist political order. Since white nationalists aim at creating the next political system, and since we are counting on the existing system to collapse under the weight of external shocks and internal corruption, it behooves us to understand where sovereignty resides in the present system. If, for example, America entered a constitutional crisis, who would exercise sovereign power to preserve the system? Where does the American deep state lie? Or better, where would it emerge? What is the system's last line of defense? Who will kill and die to preserve it? Organized Jewry is the most powerful force in America today. In terms of politics as usual, Jews get their way in all matters that concern them. But although organized Jewry surely would intersect with an American sovereign deep state, if America faced a severe constitutional crisis, I do not think that the Jews would step in to exercise the sovereign decision-making functions necessary to preserve the system. They would surely try to stave off a crisis as long as possible to preserve their wealth and power, and they would try to milk a crisis for all it's worth, but ultimately, I do not think they would risk their own blood and treasure to preserve the American system for the simple reason that the Jews today show no sign of caring about America's long-term viability. It's not their country, and they act like it. They're just using it and using it up. They're not stewarding it for future generations. Therefore, they will not take responsibility for its preservation. In a real crisis, I think their deepest instinct would be to simply decamp to friendlier climes. Would the American deep state emerge in the military? The military is currently the branch of government that Americans hold in highest esteem. But a fatal crisis might include catastrophic military failure. It might involve a standoff between the military and other institutions that can only be resolved by outside parties. It might also involve the American military massacring civilians, in which case the military would enjoy very low esteem and all Bonapartism would be off. Liberal societies may be especially brittle when faced with systematic crises because liberalism corrodes virtue and excellence. Modern political thought promised stability by founding political order on widespread vices, greed, and cowardice, rather than rare virtues like moderation, courage, wisdom, justice, and honor. But when the liberal machine breaks down, when it can no longer master crises, when it can no longer dispense rewards and punishments, when it depends for its salvation on the decisions of a sovereign, then liberalism's very existence will require the virtues that it neglects, if not outright disdains and discourages. If you want to see real terror in an American's eyes, simply propose a new constitutional convention. Most Americans would never trust their contemporaries with framing a new system because they believe correctly that they are not just silly and ignorant, but downright vicious. Wherever sovereignty would ultimately repose in a systemic crisis, wherever a deep state would emerge, what separates a true white nationalist from a mere race-conscious reactionary is recognizing the system's ultimate guardians as our worst enemies. So anyway, I think there are a lot of useful points here, and I'm wondering if folks have questions about these comments. Okay, Alaska Chaga has donated one ninjagini. What was Schmidt's relationship and influence upon Franco with Spain? I can't find details on it. That's actually an interesting question. He spent a lot of time in Spain under Franco. One of his books, which is called The Partisan, The Theory of the Partisan, is based on lectures that he delivered in Spain, I think in the 1950s or 60s. So I know he spent time there. He was not a persona non grata by any means, but I don't know much about that time, but it's an interesting question, and it would be something it would be something for a Schmidt scholar to comment on. And I just don't know the biographical details connected with that. But he certainly didn't find Franco Spain to be, a bad place that he wanted to avoid. In fact, I think he probably thought it was a pretty good order. Okay, but that is a very good question. Thank you very much. Abu Hare writes, lots of think tanks and government contractors outside DC also count as deep state. They're almost indistinguishable from the state. Well, yes and no. It really depends on how you define the deep state. If the deep state is just business as usual, that's one thing. But if the deep state is what is there in the state of the exception, if it's what's there in the state of a constitutional crisis, to step forward and do things like the Turkish deep state. The Turkish deep state is basically on the ropes, if not dead at this point. This was a basically a network of people who believed in the Ataturk's vision, the Kemalists. And of course, Turkey is now run by Islamists, right? So their ability to prevent Islamists from taking power ultimately failed. But I think there were at least three military coups in Turkey that were launched by the deep state, basically to preserve the Kemalist order. And people killed and people died in this. And of course, they engage in all kinds of skullduggery, which requires connections with organized crime and things like that. So these people are really showing their hand in emergencies. Whereas the idea of the deep state that's become practical in American political discussion now really seems to refer to business as usual. And let me say a bit more about that. This is very much connected with the essence of liberalism. Again, one of the ways you can approach liberalism as a concept is through the rejection of the idea of the common good of society. Now, some real liberals say there is no common good. They're just individual interests. Others will say, well, maybe there's a common good, but there's nothing we can do to secure it, right? The state doesn't have the power to do that. But if we allow the magic of the marketplace to have its way, we will have a situation where the common good of society is produced by selfish people pursuing their own private interests. And we don't need any public-spirited people in positions of power at the helm of the state to secure the common good. Okay, well, these public-spirited people at the helm of the state to ensure the common good is basically what the deep state is about, right? These are the people who are stepping forward in times of crisis to save the system, okay? Liberalism wants to deny that that's even necessary, right? They want to eliminate that because it scares them. You know, what if they're bad? What if they're racists? What if they're corrupt? What if they're mean? Right? You don't want people to have that kind of power. So everything has to be basically run by bureaucrats. Everything's got to follow rules, etc. We can't allow people to have that kind of power. Okay, well, what does that mean then about political deliberation? If you have a parliament and you're deliberating about laws, but the whole ethos of the society is that the very idea of politicians being broad-minded and public-spirited and looking out for the common good of society is just sort of a naive notion, right? Then what guides their deliberations? I mean, they'll talk a good game. They'll talk about what's good for America. But they ultimately believe that what's good for America is going to come about if everyone's just selfish and careerist, and that includes them. So what does that mean? Well, that means that politics in liberal societies is basically not something like the philosophical dialectic, right, that was envisioned, where, you know, wise statesmen would come together and be public-spirited, and they would they would have different views about what the common good is, and they would have these debates, and they would try and move through conversation to some kind of consensus about what the common good of society is. That's not the way it works in Washington, D.C. No, their model is the marketplace, not the philosophical dialogue, but the marketplace. What does that mean? It means that policy is bought and sold. Ultimately, that's what it means. It licenses what in healthy societies would just be dismissed as wholesale corruption. If you get justice by having your politicians be selfish careerists, what is that an invitation to do? If they think that there's no harm in being a selfish careerist, and their donors and oligarchs are selfish careerists, and the business of America is business, what possible harm could there be in conducting politics, not as a dialogue where public-spirited people try and get to the truth, but simply as bargaining, right? As basically the chamber, okay, the parliamentary chamber in America is not a philosophical dialogue. It's more like a marketplace. Although openly, it's not a marketplace. The market stuff takes place not in the chamber so much as in the lobbies outside the chamber. That's where the buying and selling of policy takes place. So when you talk about things like the military contractors and think tanks and things like that, they're really part of the ordinary day-to-day making a policy, which is just corruption. Basically, policy is bought and sold. It doesn't have to do with the functions of a deep state, which is to step forward in times of crisis, to be the system's last line of defense, right? In the movie True Lies, Arnold Schwarzenegger's character is a kind of spy, and he works for something called Omega Sector, which is a secret government operation that says it's the last line of defense, right? That's what the deep state is. It's Omega Sector. It's the last line of defense. It's the people who step forward in times of crisis to save the system. It's not just all the parties that are bargaining to basically buy policy, which is the normal state. That's the superficial state. The deep state is something else. Okay, so Thomas Dubin writes, a very foolish idea. Any constitution is only good as its people. A bad constitution with good people is better, as they will make it work. Yeah, that's true. Ultimately, you can't have this notion that we can have a good machine that's full of bored, corrupt, petty-minded people, and it's going to produce good government. It just doesn't work that way. The quality of government is determined not by the laws on the books, but by the character of the people. And there's just a deep naivete about this liberal idea that you can create a machine that will run of itself without any basis, without any necessity of a public virtue. And that's also great for education, right? Educating people in virtue is a hard thing, and very few people are virtuous. Whereas you can just educate people in technical, instrumental things. You can give them job skills. You give them job skills, and you send them out in the world, and they're selfish and narrow-minded, but the magic of the marketplace will make sure that everything works out okay. It's also really useful because people have deep disagreements about morality. So if people have deep disagreements about morality, why not just be neutral about morals, right? This is the neutralization of liberalism, right? We'll just basically put all moral questions aside. We don't need decent people to have a decent society. That's what they're hoping. It is a very foolish idea. Reed Johnson writes, a fetishization of the law. That's definitely what's going on here. It's not just a fetishization. It's just a deeply naive idea that laws can be ultimate, right? The Constitution isn't the ultimate law in America. The written Constitution isn't the ultimate law in America. If there's a Constitution in America, the ultimate Constitution is the character of the people themselves. And the trouble with liberalism in America is that the people who created the system were not products of the system they created. They were depending upon a different kind of system that shaped them. And the founders were remarkable people compared to the people who came later, but they weren't the products of the system they created. They were the products of something earlier that was there. They weren't products of Madisonian ideas of a machine that could run of itself without any input of virtue. They created the system that we live in now, and the system has steadily declined, and has steadily declined as it has basically consumed and spent the social capital that was put in place by pre-American systems. America wasn't founded by people who were raised in American democracy. It was founded by people who were raised in a colony of a kingdom. And I think that that's an important fact that needs to be understood. We need to understand why things have declined so much. Okay, so Alaska Chaga has written in with another Ninjagini. Thank you very much. What role do nonprofits and NGOs such as the Ford or Rockefeller Foundations play in the deep state? Well, again, I think that things like the Ford and the Rockefeller Foundations are more about sort of politics as usual. These are people who are steering politics as usual. They're not necessarily people who are involved in any kind of strategic planning for what would happen if there was an absolute catastrophe, a constitutional crisis or something like that. I think that is not what they do. The horrible thing that I'm contemplating in this essay really is that there is no American deep state. There are no adults. There are no people who are making contingency plans for constitutional crises and practicing, you know, figuring out what to do in those circumstances to preserve the system. There are no adults. I used to wonder about this. I used to think, okay, there's got to be sovereignty somewhere. There's got to be a decision maker somewhere. No, I don't think so. You look at the Democratic Party today. Are there any wise elders in the Democratic Party? No. If there were wise elders in the Democratic Party, they wouldn't have put Joe Biden in as president. So what's going on in the Democratic Party? Well, I think that basically what's going on there is there's just a kind of floating consensus, a kind of blob, a kind of groupthink, where there's no real leadership, right? There's nobody who's really a leader. There's nobody who's ultimately responsible. There's just sort of this drifting, amorphous consensus blob that is determining policy. That's actually a far worse idea than there being some kind of deep state, some sort of sinister omega sector, you know, where, you know, the lizard people get together to drink cocktails and things like that. That's actually optimistic, right? The true black pill, the true pessimism is the idea that there is nothing like that in America. And that when the system undergoes a crisis, it's just going to shatter into a million bits and there's nobody to take responsibility for putting it back together again. Why? Well, because we weren't founded by serious people. We're certainly not run by serious people. There might not be enough serious men in America to turn this around and save it. Even in our ranks, I mean, that's the thing that haunts me the most. Are there enough serious people in America to save this country? Or even little chunks of it? Maybe not yet, but maybe there will be. So I think NGOs and nonprofits and, you know, social clubs and Bohemian Grove and all this kind of stuff, this isn't the deep state. This is shallow state. This is politics as usual. Politics as usual in a liberal society, meaning corruption and lobbying and backroom deals and things like that. That's politics as usual. That's the shallow state. And it's shallow states all the way down. It's careerist operators. It's unserious people. It's Adam Kinzinger's all the way down. There's no deep level where you suddenly find really, really serious people. That's the most terrifying possibility. I think that could be the truth. That could very well be the truth of the matter. Now, I want to zip over to UNS.com, and I want to see if I can find this piece by our friend Steve Saylor. I'm not finding it easily. It was about this guy who created this report on China and how China was powerful because they were racist, and how America has to counter this as a multicultural society. I thought that was a fascinating story. Let me just see if I can find it at Talkie Mag. I think it's nice to occasionally go over to Talkie's Mag because they only have 65% of the traffic that we have here. Here it is. Steve Saylor, The Unicultural Edge. Okay, I'm going to just read part of this because this has a hint of what an American deep state operation sort of might be like. Okay, a formerly secret 2013 Pentagon report. And somebody, I'm going to link this in the chat first. So you want to follow along, you can do that. Okay. A formerly secret 2013 Pentagon report, The Strategic Consequences of Chinese Racism, a Strategic Asymmetry for the United States, argues China is a racist superpower. It makes for eye-opening reading on how both the Chinese people and the American deep state think. He's being very polite, calling it a deep state. Okay. This book-length paper, which was posted online as a result of Freedom of Information Act litigation and then discovered by Twitter user something, Decatur, is by an author whose name remains redacted. But we know for sure that it was commissioned by the legendary nonagenarian strategist Andrew Marshall. This shadowy Mandarin started his career as a machinist in Detroit during World War II, then joined the RAND Corporation in 1949 to do Dr. Strangelove-like nuclear war planning. Henry Kissinger brought him to the Nixon White House, and in 1973, Defense Secretary James Schlesinger created the enigmatic Office of Net Assessment. I love that name, the Office of Net Assessment, for Marshall to think deep thoughts like a terrestrial Harry Seldon about the future of superpower rivalries. He served as director of net assessment in a windowless suite of Pentagon offices for 42 years under 13 secretaries of defense until his retirement in 2015 at age 93, when he was said to be the oldest federal worker ever. A Chinese general considered Marshall perhaps China's wisest foe and referred to the ancient seer as Yoda. Nobody outside the Pentagon knows all that much about his views. Not even secretaries of defense were allowed to keep copies of his highest level write-ups known as net assessments. Only one copy of each was printed, and when the cabinet officer finished reading it, Marshall put it back in his safe. Okay, that gives you a sense of the flavor of something that may be sort of deep state-like, right? This guy's retired. You wonder if he's been replaced by anybody. And in the end, you know, are there people serious enough to read these reports and act on them? They know that China is a racist superpower, and what does our military plan to do to counter them? To have more diversity and inclusion. So they're not any serious people. I mean, there is this one serious guy who's now retired in the Office of Net Assessment, and he might have not even been that serious, right? But let's just, on the hypothesis, you know, let's be polite. Think that he was a serious guy. Okay, he created these reports. People read them. They went back in his safe. Were there any serious people following him? Right? I don't know. It's very, very interesting. Given the absolute mess that America's in, there might be no serious guys in any of these administrations. Like I said, it might be shallow states all the way down. It might be Adam Kinzinger's all the way down. There might not be some ultimate level, some last line of defense, some omega sector, some people who want to take ultimate responsibility. And that's a really, really scary thought. However, it's only a scary thought if you really want the American thing to survive, right? we're dissidents. We want this system to fail. And so it's actually a very empowering thought for us, because we're not invested in the future of this system anyway. We're invested in its failure, and it might be a lot more fragile than we think. So there are a few comments here I want to read. The shallow state is in deep shit. Yes, this is true. I hope it is. Okay. Lots of the tranny stuff is pushed by NGOs. This is true. There are huge problems in spreading the pause. But the question is, are they the ultimate sovereign actors, or are there no such things in America? Who will die for Globo Homo? Non-Goyim organizations. I used to balk when the U.S. was referred to as being the great Satan. Well, yeah, I used to balk at that too. But you know, there's something worse than being the great Satan, which is being the great retard. Basically, you know, you can at least respect Satan as an evil genius, but can you respect Adam Kinzinger? You know, if the ultimate deep state is just retards, you know, who get all of their ideas from Twitter and BuzzFeed, that's far more terrifying than America being the great Satan. America is the great retard, you know, with its retard strength threatening the stability and happiness of the world. Okay, Abu Hari writes, years ago, a guy named Mark Lofgren defined deep state as a conspiracy in plain sight. But that's the shallow state. That's business as usual. It's all out there in plain sight. Archie writes in, would part of the shallow state be NGOs that promote Holocaust education in China among the citizens, thus changing the metapolitics? Well, you know, if people are engaged in that kind of stuff, yeah, I don't know if that's the deep state, but that's long-term thinking. It's certainly not our deep state. That would be the ADL, right? And there is a nation that does have a deep state. If anybody's got a deep state, I mean, if Egypt has a deep state and America doesn't that just make you ashamed as an American? My ears are starting to feel warm thinking at the thought that Egypt is a more serious society than the United States. But you know one society that's even more serious than Egypt? That is Israel. And not just Israel, but Jews in general as a nation, they have a deep state. They think very, very carefully and seriously about long-term strategy and planning. And they have people who will come forward and kill and die for their collective. There's no question about that. I think they'd feel safer if America didn't have anybody like that, right? America is just sort of something that could be tossed around easily by them if there's no ultimate level of responsibility. If it's not a serious society, it's just an easy victim. basically. But, you know, Jews think very, very long term, and they have all kinds of layers of depth. America, it's the shallow state all the way down, sadly. At least that's my hope. When you get right down to it, it's my hope. The CIA has admitted it can't penetrate China with spies because of their racial homogeneity. Interesting point. Diversity, not a strength. Israel has never had any trouble penetrating the United States because of the because we've got so many Jews in positions of authority. And I only think there's been one case of a Jew who was contacted by Israel who reported that to his or her superiors. I guess all the others just go along with it. There's also a pattern of ethnic Chinese citizens spying for China. That also goes with Jews too. Okay. Yeah, walk around in red high heels. That'll show the Chinese. Yes, we're going to have the gayest missiles ever. And that'll stop the Chinese. I love to watch the you-know-whos debase their war machine. Yeah, I like to watch that too. Report could be summarized as diversity plus proximity equals war. Well, I mean, it's not so much that. It's just that a serious society with homogeneity is stronger than an unserious society that promotes diversity and inclusion. And they were given this to look at. And as far as I know, nobody's taken it very seriously. So that's interesting. The great retard, yes. Under this definition, an entity strong enough to take charge in emergencies. I suppose Greg might be right that there's no deep state. He continues, but there are very powerful groups and individuals who stay around in government and do not stand for election. Yeah, that's true. But I think that's the shallow state. There's the really shallow state, which consists of the rotating public elites, right? The people in Congress and so forth, people in the cabinet and so forth. These people are ephemeral. Then there's a slightly deeper, but still shallow state, which is the permanent bureaucracy, all the operators, the behind the scenes, the lobbying groups and things like that, right? That's a somewhat deeper shallow state. But I still think we're thinking about ultimately the shallow state here. We've already had a token female pilot wreck an F-35 and send it into the ocean. That's how we're going to beat the Chinese. That's exactly how we're going to beat the Chinese. Okay, I'm going to pop back over to Odyssey and see if there are some new comments. Okay, so we have 51 people over at Odyssey right now, and we've got about 94 people right now here. Not bad, given that I'm just rambling on about Schmidt, so I appreciate it. Let me check at Entropy and see if we've got some new questions or comments here. Thin Red Line, thank you, CC, sends $5. Thank you very much. I have a couple questions that were sent in by Eric. I just need to check the email for that. Eric is a very helpful guy. He sends me lots of recommendations for book reviews, some of which actually get reviewed. So he has a number of questions for me, and just short questions. And folks, if you want to throw out some short questions, now's your time. You know, are you watching the Winter Olympics in Beijing? No, I'm not. But the best Olympics is Winter Olympics, in my opinion. And do I have any favorite sports for Winter Olympics? Anything connected with skiing? I love that. He asks, why are white people attracted to extreme sports? I think it's thumos, basically. I think it's like a nice combination of high thumos with intelligence and imagination. I think that's what explains it. The less thumotic peoples don't get into extreme sports, and the less intelligent peoples don't get into extreme sports. You have to have like a nice combination of intelligence and thumos, animal vitality, and desire to do crazy things. Sometimes thumos expresses itself that way. I'm not going to talk about what I did in high school. but he does ask what my favorite film trilogy is, which is a good question. And I find that very difficult because there are two that are up there. One is The Lord of the Rings, Peter Jackson, and the other is The Dark Knight trilogy, Christopher Nolan. Ultimately, I guess I would have to say that it's The Lord of the Rings just because it's a real sentimental favorite and it's very moving emotionally. Nolan's stuff is really deep and interesting and also, a great spectacle. Some of it's very, very touching, though. I have to say that The Dark Knight Rises is a very emotionally moving film for me. So they're about tied, but I think even though The Hobbits are shorter than Batman, they stand a little taller than him in my estimation. Okay. So let's check and see if there are any other questions or comments here. And if not, we can just wrap up early after, of course, recommend highly Nick Gilvey tomorrow, who's doing, extreme sports equals the Faustian spirit. There's no question about that. Yeah, it's a very white thing. There's no question about that. So yeah, I think that basically wraps it up. Folks, I want to recommend that you tune in tomorrow at the same channel at a slightly different time for the Writer's Block, Nick Gilvey's show. Nick Gilvey's The Writer's Block starts at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, and at 10 o'clock Central European time where he is. And we are going to continue his Canada theme. And I have to say that that's a good theme because I'm very, very happy with our Canadian cousins to the north. I actually have Canadian cousins, and I'm very, very impressed with them standing up to this ridiculous goofball tyrant. So he's welcoming Endeavor, who is a Canadian, to talk about George Grant, who is a Canadian political philosopher, Canadian nationalism, and current events like the truckers' protest. So that will be tomorrow at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, and 10 p.m. Central European time at Countercurrents. I want to thank everybody who's tuned in. I want to thank the donors for donating, the moderators for moderating, the people in the chat. It's been very cozy and friendly. And I'm looking forward to doing this again next week. Next week, what I've decided to do, just to give you a teaser, is I'm going to cover my essay, Three Pillars of White Identity Politics, which is published in the book White Identity Politics. And I think I'll have time to cover the whole thing. And so I will put that essay up in sort of a fresh post this coming week to give people time to read it. And we're going to continue this. We're going to do Three Pillars of White Identity Politics. And then on March 5th, we're going to talk about more Carl Schmitt, because I enjoy talking about Schmitt. I've invited Mark Collett to come on March 12th because he shamed me for not inviting him onto these shows. So anyway, we can look forward to the Writer's Block tomorrow and Three Pillars of White Identity Politics next week on Countercurrents Radio. So thank you very much, and we will be back.